Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Amanda Vinicky. Brandis Friedman has the evening off. Here's what we're looking at. People who are experiencing homelessness may soon be banned from sleeping outside in some cities. Questions remain after last week's train derailment in Madison. The city's mayor joins us to talk about what we know so far about the investigation. And Chicago's Piping Plover family just expanded. And now to some of today's top stories. American presidents cannot be criminally penalized for illegal actions, as long as those actions were done in an official capacity. But today's ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court says that immunity does not apply to unofficial acts. The 6-3 opinion could have a sweeping impact on the presidency and on the Justice Department's prosecution of former President Donald Trump for attempting to overturn his loss in the 2020 race. It's up to a trial court whether Trump's efforts to hold on to the White House were official and protected or not. Governor J.B. Pritzker, a top backer of President Joe Biden, says no one, including a president, should be above the law and that Trump needs to answer for his actions. It won't likely be resolved before the November election. Should Trump win, he could order the election subversion case be dropped completely. Illinois driver's licenses and state IDs are available to undocumented immigrants for the first time. Since 2013, non-permanent and undocumented residents have been eligible for temporary visitor's driver's licenses. But immigrant advocates say those led to discrimination, and the markings meant they couldn't be used as IDs for getting a bank account, applying to rent an apartment, or to pick up a prescription.
And it's not some pie in the sky idea that we're trying to solve here. This is everyday things that people rely on. Can you imagine trying to pick up a prescription from the pharmacy and not being able to do so? That is awful. That was awful that happened. Now we're changing that. And so
applicants need to present a passport or consulate card, and getting a driver's license also requires proof of insurance and passing driving tests. Advocates say the more people with licenses, the safer the roads. Under the new law, license information cannot be used for immigration enforcement. The Secretary of State's office says it has safeguards to prevent ineligible immigrants from receiving real IDs and from being added to voting rolls. Westside residents are frustrated. Today marks a year since storms caused flooding in Austin and Lawndale. They say hundreds of homes are still moldy, and most of the remediation that has been done is thanks to philanthropy.
I'm just sad. Because it hurts me to see our seniors, who are the pillars of this community, who pay taxes in this community, can't get city help. Can't get city help.
We reached out to the city for comment, but did not hear back. Illinois is signing on to a $1 billion-plus project to keep invasive and ecologically destructive carp out of the Great Lakes. After years of negotiations, the state has agreed to a deal to spend $50 million on what's known as the Brandon Road Interbasin Project. It'll be built on the Illinois River near Joliet with the intent of keeping the fish from accessing Lake Michigan via the river. Illinois' approval allows the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to go forward with the federal project. Up next, a move to ban people experiencing homelessness from sleeping outside. A look at the potential impact right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
An increase in homelessness has cities across America searching for solutions. Some, including Grants Pass in Oregon, are turning to punishment, such as fines or even arrest, for those sleeping in public areas. That practice can continue. Under a recent ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, the decision is expected to have a sweeping impact on policies for the unhoused. But advocates are hoping the effect will be muted in Chicago and in Illinois. Joining us now with more are Patricia Nix Hodges, the director of the Law Project with the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, and via Zoom, Bob Palmer, policy director at Housing Action Illinois. Thanks to each of you. And so, Patricia, I would like to begin with you from the legal perspective. This overturns cases from lower courts that had deemed this to be cruel and unusual punishment. Can you explain?
Yes. So there have been a series of cases in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers the Western states, that found that banning people from sleeping outside could be cruel and unusual punishment, especially in communities where there's no shelter available. That was the facts of the case. There was no shelter available, and if people had so little as a blanket to sleep outside, they could be arrested, fined, or ticketed. And the lower courts found that was cruel and unusual punishment and therefore unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment.
And a brief description of what the justices decided in overturning that.
Yeah, so they overturned the decision. So now they said that cities would be permitted to ticket, fine, arrest people for using a blanket or anything like a rolled up shirt as a pillow in these communities.
A where, box, a blanket,
yeah,
anything.
Yeah, where no shelter is available.
And more on that, I want to read a piece of the majority opinion that was written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, who wrote that homelessness is complex. Its causes are many. People will disagree over which policy responses are best. They may experiment with one set of approaches, only to find later another set works better. They might find certain responses more appropriate for some communities than others, but in our democracy, that is their right. So, Bob, you have long been working in the area of homelessness prevention and solving these issues. It is complex. Is this an appropriate potential solution for communities to at least try?
Well, I would push back a bit against the position that this is a complex problem. There's lots of individual reasons, lots of individual stories about people who experience homelessness. But in the end, what everyone who's homeless has in common is they can't afford housing. So we're very troubled that the Supreme Court decision is essentially allowing for criminalization of what is essentially an economic problem caused by the shortage of affordable housing.
So is that the answer to this then? Because folks, I think, are concerned. What are the solutions? So you're saying what? Fines, that's not the answer. Instead, resolve it earlier.
Yes, obviously, to end homelessness, we need to create affordable housing and treat it as a human right, basic human need in our society. As we get on the path to get there, we really need more constructive solutions to deal with people who are unsheltered and homeless, focused on social services, outreach. There are some good examples in Illinois. For example, in suburban Cook County has a relatively new partnership with Metra to address homelessness on the transit system. Rockford is another community where they have more of a social service perspective on addressing unsheltered homelessness. Treating it as a criminal problem doesn't end the person's homelessness, and it creates a lot of additional cost for society and obviously the negative impact on the person who is penalized through the criminal justice system is really negative and actually makes it more complicated and more difficult for them to actually end their homelessness if they're being treated like a criminal.
In the sense that if you're fined, presumably you may not even have the money to pay that fine, sets you down a further path to not being able to afford housing. Is that what we're talking about, Patricia?
Yes,
exactly.
And also, the fines can accumulate. There can be late fees. It can impact your credit report, which could impact your ability to get housed. And then similarly, having an arrest or a conviction on your record can cause a barrier to housing.
And of course, this is all the policy in a community in Oregon. But is this more widespread? Do you think that we're going to see more communities adopting this sort of approach?
I hope not. That is definitely a concern, but I would say a couple of things to that concern. One is it's not effective. For the reasons Bob has mentioned, it makes homelessness worse because people have more difficulty getting housed because of a record and because of credit issues. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. So that's one thing. It's not effective. Things like housing and homelessness prevention are effective. The other thing is just because the Supreme Court has overturned this order doesn't mean cities should just go into a mode of being reactionary and criminalizing people for biological necessities. Justice Sotomayor said in her opinion, the very first sentence, sleep is a biological necessity, not a crime. And then particularly in Chicago and Illinois, I think there is a recognition that criminalization is not effective, a housing first approach is effective, and that seems to be the direction that people here want to move.
So, Bob, turning to you, is this an approach that you could see, perhaps not the city of Chicago, which has seen an increase in the number of unhoused individuals, particularly, I believe, with the addition of migrants coming in, sort of exacerbating that. But is this an approach that you could see communities in Illinois adopting, or would there be anything in state law preventing that?
Well, Illinois for many years has had a homeless bill of rights. It doesn't explicitly restrict communities from doing camping bans, but it provides a lot of strong protections to make sure that law enforcement and other government agencies aren't targeting people in a negative way just because they're homeless, as well as protecting their personal property. And actually at the state level under Governor Pritzker, one really good thing that's happened is that the Illinois Department of Human Services and the Illinois Office of Prevention and Homelessness has worked closely with Illinois State Police to come up with a guidebook for law enforcement that includes many of these more constructive solutions. For example, making sure that law enforcement is always working with social service organizations to make sure you're dealing with the underlying need that the person has and not just penalizing them.
And Bob, we have about 30 seconds left. So just, is Illinois doing enough? More money has been put toward this, but the problem continues to grow.
Illinois is doing much more than it had been, but no, it's not enough at all levels of government, the federal government, state government, and local governments. We really need to be coming from a perspective, again, that housing is a human right, it's a basic human need, and commit sufficient resources to make sure everyone has it.
And thank you so much for that perspective, Bob Palmer. And Patricia, I should add that you actually had written an amicus brief that
yes.
was a part of this. So for any legal eagles out there, check that out, and we'll try to post that on our website. Thank
okay.
you for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, the mayor of Madison on the massive train derailment last week. Stay with us. Trains are running again after a 25-car freight train carrying various substances derailed, forcing nearly 300 residents from their homes in Madison, Illinois last week. No one was reportedly harmed in the accident, and Canadian National Railway says there is no threat to public safety, despite the evacuation, leaks, and eventual controlled burn of liquid petroleum gas off 11 train cars. Now investigators are trying to piece together the cause of the derailment and remediation of the accident site is going to take weeks. Joining us with more are the mayor of Madison, that's Sheila Chalmers-Curran, and Joseph Schwederman, a professor of sustainable urban development at DePaul University. I'm going to begin with you, Mayor. Can you describe the scene that unfolded on Thursday?
Well, the scene was unfolded within 10:34, we received a call indicating a derailment. And by 10:37, my police and fire were both on the scene.
Quick action.
So that was great. They've had training in order to do that. And so that training went into effect and they did what they were supposed to do. We did everything we had to do.
Which is what? Yeah.
As a precaution, what we did is we made sure that individuals were evacuated from the area, not knowing at the time what was there, and that if it was something toxic, we wanted to make sure our residents were safe. So we evacuated as a precaution. And so that was done. Right now, where we are right now is that they've done what is called a flaring of the residue that was left there, and that has been done, and it is cleared away. So we still have some of those cars there that are available right there, but they're to be removed soon, and we're hoping that we can get back to normal. So, yeah.
Hoping to get back to normal, but first, Mr. Schroeder, what is the cause of the derailment? Do we know anything about that?
You know, credit for the city for really taking action quickly to solve this, because there's been a vacuum of information. When I heard it was at this crossing in Madison, it was like, oh boy, this is a high-intensity freight junction, almost a whole clover leaf in which trains move from one line to another. Metro and Amtrak come through there. So you have, you know, tremendous risks, and I think, you know, we dodged a bullet here with tank cars derailing. But thankfully, they weren't fully loaded. And of course, the city and the railroad took action. But this was a scary one.
Let's hone in on that. When you say dodged a bullet, is this just happenstance, no matter what? And this is, of course, not a discredit to emergency services for having to react with whatever passes. Is there tracking, for example, when there are toxic substances so communities know what they're dealing with?
Well, the railroads do have limits. So if you're carrying class three inflammables, you have to limit the number of tank cars. You got to lower the speed. But there's a bit of a lag effect. The federal government has ruled that the newer tank cars have to be replaced, the old ones, safer ones. But that's not coming until next year. So there's a lot of these older cars out there that aren't quite as safe as, you know, the newer ones hitting the rails. So we've seen enough bad accidents in the country. I mean, East Palestine, Ohio is one. Yeah. Lamantic in Quebec, just terrible outcomes. And this train is moving at fairly slow speeds. I'm not saying it was imminent, but it's scary when tank cars come off the rails.
You talked about the East Palestine situation. And what similarities could we see between what is possible in communities such as Madison, where you have these cloverleaf crossings and a bunch of cars carrying passengers and freight, and what happened there?
Well, I think, you know, one thing we see different here is just immediate communication with the residents. People are scared when they see these cars come off, and especially when it's a tank car. Notifying people, getting them out of there. When the flaring happened, people knew that was coming. But I can say we're grappling with this as a country. I mean, the pipeline production development has slowed down with a lot of NIMBYs for pipelines. So a lot of that crude and toxic chemicals are moving by the rail. So I think, you know, we're kind of come to grips with that. And the last thing we want to do is push that cargo off onto the roads. So it's a tough situation.
What are you hearing from residents? Is this sparking new fears that they thought perhaps, oh, this wouldn't happen in our area?
Well, first of all, when we had the conversation, my police chief mentioned that we've been in training for this if it ever happens. And they have done this every year. Both fire and police have done training for this, and then it happened. So what has happened now is by giving them information indicating that we're safe has been very good with helping them feel safe about the way things are going right now. Residents are, of course, wanting to be concerned, and we have kept them abreast of everything we've been doing, and we've been communicating with not only with CN, but also communicating with our state and federal government. We've had calls from Senator Durbin, Senator Duckworth, Congresswoman Kelly, the governor's office, all are wanting to make sure that we can get that information out and make sure that individuals know that this particular what we had there with the liquid petroleum gas is not toxic to or a risk to the public. And so that in itself makes them feel a lot safer.
That's what you've been communicating, and
we're
you're able
continue
to say
to
that
do
unequivocally.
That. Right, yes.
What is the cost of the damage to your community?
Well, that's to be determined. We, of course, had overtime with our police and fire. Our public works was involved with this, and that is still to be determined because we're still actively involved in keeping that area safe and making sure that individuals that go through that area cannot right now go completely through that without having a police and fire there to protect them. So,
how long will this cause a disruption? We'll get back to some of the more long-term ramifications, but right now, are commuters and perhaps some shippers out of luck?
Well, you're lucky that it's a very high-capacity railroad. So Metra uses separate tracks. Those pretty much were back to normal pretty quick. Mm-hmm. The upper line, the CN, formerly Central Line, was back pretty quick, too. But, boy, that interchange is going to take some time to get that back. And that's going to, you know, set back some freight logistics in this region. It's a major interchange. And I will say that, you know, our region is grappling with this. We have Metra lines that share lines with freight trains. We were lucky that this line, they have separate tracks, and I think that's helped get things back to normal.
Is that something that's going to change? I've taken the Amtrak and Metra a time or 200 in my life and certainly been held up when an Amtrak train is trying to get somewhere, and lo and behold, there's freight that keeps it back for an hour.
You know, it's relevant to this accident because what we're seeing is railroads with this precision scheduled railroading concept really making these trains longer and longer. And I used to think 2 miles was the max. We're now pushing 2.2 or so. So there's tremendous, physical pressure on those couplers and others. So you have more derailments, but the trains are often moving at slower speeds. The tracks are well maintained. So our country really is in a tough spot here with wanting to use those rails for passenger as these trains get longer and longer.
And this, yes, of course, as you noted, Chicago's region is central to this, just given how much freight traffic there is.
That's exactly right. The bipartisan infrastructure bill has lots of funding to build new passing tracks and so forth. But cities like Madison, this is a big part of your life.
It's a big part of our life right now, and we've done everything we could to make sure that we continue to keep our residents safe. We're great and glad that it's continued to happen that way.
We're very glad for that as well. Yes. Especially glad for that. Thanks also, and glad for your time with us to explain all of this.
Thank you for having us here. Thank you.
All right. Now up next, Chicago's newest residents on the lakefront. Stay with us. Move over, cicadas. There are some new arrivals in town. The legacy of the beloved piping plovers, Monty and Rose, lives on at Montrose Beach. Their son, Imani, now a father himself. WTTW News reporter Patty Wetley joins us now with more on the exciting news. Patty, what is the latest on these plover chicks?
Yes, so our boy Imani and his mate Sea Rocket have been incubating 4 eggs, and yesterday we found out 3 of them had hatched, and then this morning, the 4th one. So they are now a family of 6 on Montrose Beach.
Very exciting. I love that.
Exciting, as you said.
It is. I love that the mom and dad switch off duties here.
Yes, they do.
That's refreshing. No offense to the father of my child, of course. Okay, remind us again, what is so significant about these birds in the area?
Well, if you remember 5 years ago, who even knew what a piping plover was? And then Monty and Rose settled in at Montrose Beach and became these great ambassadors for this endangered species. You know, not that long ago, there were only 12 breeding pairs in the entire Great Lakes. This year, we're closing in on 80, which is a great mark to have reached at this point, but there used to be hundreds. So great recovery efforts underway, and it's awesome to see that, you know, we now have nesting birds and chicks at Montrose and also up north in Waukegan. So we've got 2 plover families in Illinois where for a good 50 years there was really nothing besides Monty and Rose, prior to Monty and Rose. So they've been really scarce in our neck of the woods.
You cannot be a Chicagoan and not know who Monty and Rose are.
Exactly.
Briefly, in Waukegan, how many baby plovers do we have?
We know we've got 3 there for sure at the last count, and I think there was also a 4th indeterminate one.
And what are the names of the parents
there?
Blaze
and Pepper are the parents there.
Blaze and Pepper.
Good on Blaze and Pepper.
Skyrocket and Imani. Okay, what should people know, however, if they are going to Montrose Beach, either to maybe catch a glimpse of their new neighbors?
Right.
Should they even be doing that?
Well, I mean, you want to see the little fluff balls, but give them their space. Respect the fencing, the protective area of beach. You'll see plover monitors there. But, you know, these little chicks, they're mobile as soon as they're born. So they might not know where that fencing line is. So, you know, watch where you're stepping. They're very tiny. If you're taking a dog to the beach, for sure, keep it on a leash. Try and pick up trash because that actually attracts gulls, which are one of the biggest threats to these little chicks.
They want to eat them up.
They want to eat them up.
They literally want to eat them.
Yes. So, you know, just basically be respectful of them and understand, like, how exciting it is that they're here and we want to protect them, make sure that they grow up, you know, to be able to migrate south, come back, start their own families.
And you're a roving plover reporter, Patty. Yes. Have you actually seen them?
I saw Imani like 10 days ago, and I want to go down to the beach tomorrow to see if I can see the chicks.
Well, we'll be checking your Twitter for
yes, for sure.
Thank you for your reporting,
Thanks,
Patty.
Amanda.
You can read Patty's full story on our website. That's at WTTW.com/news. And we're back to wrap things up right after this. And that's our show for this Monday night. Don't forget, you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website. And please join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and at 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a great night enjoying this beautiful weather.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm dedicated to preserving the dignity and rights of all individuals.